Just say a brief bit about Christopher. Christopher is currently the William Donald Bain Family Professor of Corporate Law at Washington and Lee University in the United States. Although I think it's now public knowledge that he has just been appointed to a highly prestigious chair at the University of Georgia. So we will soon be knowing him as of that affiliation. Christopher's scholarship focuses on corporate law and securities regulation. And unlike most, I think it's fair to say most scholars in the field of US corporate law, Christopher is a very outward-looking scholar, not only an expert in US law, but also comparative law, with particular regard to the interrelation between corporate law and politics, not just in the US, but in other countries, particularly other English-speaking common law countries. Christopher's book, Corporate Governance in the Common Law World, The Political Foundations of Shareholder Power, has been called a revelation and a work of monumental significance and scholarly craft, and it's recently been translated into Chinese. So he has very much an international profile, and he's just very recently published a book called Reimagining Offshore Finance, Market-Dominant Small Jurisdictions in a Globalising Financial World, which I'm just going to show you by the bottom cover, covered up, because he actually published it with an inferior publisher. A university city, that's not this one, but anyway, that's Christopher's most recent book. Without further ado, I will hand over to Christopher.
Great. Well, many thanks for that kind and generous introduction, and I'll just, it's Mark and Roberta have really said it all in terms of the nature of the series and our ambitions for it, but I'll just add that I'm very excited to be part of that effort to work with Mark and Roberta and others at Hart, and we'll look forward to speaking with any of you who may have projects that you're considering that might be suitable for this series. So over the last several years, as you've just heard, my work on corporate law has focused quite heavily on political economy dimensions of corporate governance, and a lot of that work for me has been comparative in nature. And I should note that it's really here at Cambridge, when I had a chance to visit back in 2009 and interact with Professor Cheffins and others at the point where my interest in these fields was really sort of budding, that I turned to these subjects in earnest, and it's a particular pleasure to be back here. I'm grateful to Mark for the invitation, and also to 3CL, to the law faculty, and to their sponsors for the opportunity to be here with you. Now, the core question that's addressed by this paper that I'm working on is why the political left in the United States has expressed differing normative views on corporate governance at state versus federal levels. And we'll turn to that shortly, but first I want to give just a little bit of background that I think will help everyone make sense of the question, why I'm posing it in the way I am and why I'm approaching it in the way that I am. So in my scholarship on U.S. corporate law, I've developed an account of the field's ambivalence, as I see it, regarding three fundamental issues of the field. First, the locus of ultimate corporate governance authority. Is it the board of directors or is it the shareholders? Second, who are the intended beneficiaries of corporate production? Is it the shareholders or is it some more broadly conceived set of stakeholders that would certainly include the shareholders and perhaps even prioritize them relative to others, but not necessarily to the exclusion of other stakeholders like employees, creditors, and so on. And then third, the relationship of corporate law and the corporation and the achievement of the social good. So here, in essence, is the question is, whoever the intended beneficiaries are, to what extent can we assume that they actually proxy well for the larger social goals that we hope to achieve by fostering corporate production in this way? Now, in each instance, I think that the inquiry ultimately reveals itself to be largely driven by ambivalence regarding shareholders themselves. And I argue that in U.S. corporate law, we essentially find real but incomplete confidence in terms of the consistency of shareholders' interests and incentives with those of the larger public whose good this mode of production is supposed to advance. Now, all of these issues are obviously hotly contested, both descriptively and normatively, and accordingly, we have a number of theories of corporate governance that come out differently regarding how we should conceptualize both corporate power and corporate purpose. Now, for the sake of illustration, I've categorized some prominent examples here. At one extreme, we have strict shareholder primacy, which favors giving shareholders relatively more robust governance powers, that is, direct power to exert themselves vis-a-vis the governance of the company, and then further favors requiring that the board of directors itself focus its decision-making very intently on shareholder interest as opposed to any competing interests. At the other extreme, then, we've got something like team production, which favors strong board powers, but at the same time favors requiring that the board act as a so-called mediating hierarch, in essence charged with balancing all of the different interests and incentives of the various constituencies that are making firm-specific investments in one way or another in the business of the company. In between, then, we've got other theories that that vary in terms of their degree of favoring board versus shareholder power and shareholder versus stakeholder orientation. Now, the interesting phenomenon that I'm investigating is that when you look squarely at the political left in the United States, so a set of actors who you would assume share broadly compatible views and generally do, we find those focusing on state-level corporate law normatively gravitating toward the lower right corner of this chart, right? So when the political left is focusing on state-level corporate law, they tend to move toward the bottom right of the chart, favoring stronger board powers rather than robust shareholder governance powers, and tending to favor stakeholder orientation rather than strict shareholder orientation. When we shift our focus to the federal level, then, at the federal level, it tends to be the case that the left will gravitate toward the top left of the chart, right? So at the state level, the political left tends to focus here. At the federal level, the political left tends to gravitate normatively toward the top left of the chart, favoring strong shareholders and strong shareholder orientation in corporate decision making. So my paper aims to explain why this has happened. And I think it's an interesting question because it requires grappling with inconsistencies among a group who, again, one would have expected to have broadly compatible normative views on these types of issues. And it further requires grappling with some political alignments that contradict what political scientists generally associate with the political left. Now, interestingly, shareholder-centric conceptions of the corporation and corporate law have long been described by the corporate law literature as politically right-leaning, whereas stakeholder-oriented conceptions of the corporation and corporate law have tended to be associated with the political left. So in a sense, the question here really becomes why it happens that when the frame of reference shifts to the federal level within the U.S. political economy, this curious reversal occurs. Why do federal actors associated with the political left champion expansion of shareholders' corporate governance powers, notably through federal securities regulation, but not exclusively as a matter of securities regulation, often through other modes of regulation as well? So, for example, at the state level, we find the left endorsing robust capacity for boards to defend against hostile takeovers, often by reference to the interests of non-shareholders. But then at the federal level, we find the Democratic Party pursuing all sorts of securities law reforms that strongly favor shareholders, most notably through the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 that followed the Enron and WorldCom meltdowns, but then also through the Dodd-Frank Act that resulted from the recent financial crisis. My goal here is to explain this political disconnect. Now, these are complex phenomena, I think quite obviously, and undoubtedly they reflect the interaction of multiple variables. And in the paper, I investigate a number of possibilities, some of which have received substantial attention in the literature on U.S. corporate federalism, while others have received less attention, at least in the corporate context. Now, the corporate federalism literature in the U.S. typically focuses on state-to-state competition and then engages to some degree in macro-level analysis of state versus federal corporate lawmaking. But when we turn our focus to varying preferences among actors at a particular end of the left-right political spectrum, we find that the sorts of institutional and political distinctions that are often highlighted don't necessarily break the way that we might have anticipated that they would, and that there's a wider array of actors and regulatory bodies that we have to examine in order to be able to make sense of all this. Now, first, there's the substantive distinction between corporate law and securities regulation. Now, even though Congress has clear and expansive constitutional authority to federalize corporate law if it likes, it hasn't done so. This field has traditionally been left to the states, and under perhaps peculiar choice of law rule called the Internal Affairs Doctrine, it is generally the law of the state of incorporation, normally Delaware for publicly traded companies, that will govern the corporation's internal affairs, even if it's headquartered elsewhere and its operations typically are pursued elsewhere. Securities regulation, by contrast, has been predominantly a federal subject ever since the core federal securities laws were enacted in the early 1930s in the wake of the stock market crash of the late 20s and the onset of the Great Depression. Now, given that the very purpose of securities law is investor protection, we would naturally expect it to skew strongly in the direction of shareholder protection. That is what securities law does by its very nature. Now, this distinction certainly helps explain the varying degrees of shareholder centrism exhibited by these two fields of law. That is, if we're comparing corporate law to securities regulation, this distinction is very important indeed. But remember that I'm asking a different question. This distinction doesn't in and of itself necessarily illuminate why we would have a divide between left-leaning voices at the state and federal levels in terms of their normative preferences. Now, as I noted, traditional political associations would lead us to expect the left to adopt positions at the federal level that resemble the sorts of positions the left has taken vis-a-vis corporate law at the state level, yet we find exactly the opposite. Another important distinction is that between Delaware and Washington as sites of regulatory production. Now, as Mark Rowe in particular has explored at length, Delaware faces no real competition from other states at this point in terms of attracting incorporations. That competition is essentially won for Delaware, and it's widely accepted that their position is more or less unassailable except in very particular niche areas. So really, Delaware's competition is D.C. The real competitive threat for Delaware is federal intervention into the field of corporate law and corporate governance. Now, for our purposes, the critical distinction is that D.C. brings different inputs to bear on the policymaking process. Delaware, through the lens of corporate law, will tend to focus on directors and shareholders as potential actors. In D.C., on the other hand, there's a much broader range of interests that bring themselves to bear upon policy production, and particularly in the wake of a crisis capturing national attention, these differing voices impacting federal interventions into the field of corporate governance can have a real impact and can produce outcomes that might differ markedly from how that question would be treated if it were before the Delaware courts and or the Delaware legislature. Now, all of this is undoubtedly correct, and I think it goes a long way toward illuminating the degree to which Delaware acts in the shadow of D.C. all the time, even when there's not an overt threat from D.C. But note that distinctions about which actors tend to be operative at each level of government, again, don't resolve the question that I'm addressing here, because we have an identifiable political left at both state and federal levels who don't behave consistently. And that includes particular categories of actors who have themselves taken inconsistent positions in these two settings under various circumstances. As we'll discuss momentarily, organized labor supported the so-called constituency statutes at the state level, which help insulate boards of directors from scrutiny when they act to impede a hostile takeover, and those statutes often directly legitimate reference to the interests of non-shareholders in making those decisions. But then at the federal level, organized labor has supported strongly shareholder-centric corporate governance reform efforts, including initiatives aimed at reducing barriers to hostile takeovers. Now, this suggests that a full explanation of this state-federal divide that really preoccupies me here is going to require some kind of account of the perceived interests of labor in particular, and how those interests have been formulated in different types of market and legal settings and at different points in time. We'll come back to that shortly. Now, obviously, a critical development in exploring the state-federal divide is the rise of institutional investors. And this happened at a very different point in time in the United States than it did in the UK. Here in the UK, institutions became big players in the decades following World War II, but in the US, it really wasn't until arguably the late 1970s, but really the 1980s, that institutions became really prominent. Today, there's no gainsaying that they are the dominant actors in US capital markets. Now, holding as much stock as they do, they're no longer the passive bystanders that shareholders in the paradigmatic Burley Means Corporation were said to be. And this has naturally fostered the emergence of very effective advocates for shareholder-centric policies. Now, this greater capacity for activism has really hinged on reinvigorating use of voting power on those limited matters where U.S. corporate law actually allows shareholders to vote, most significantly electing directors. Now, this doesn't answer our question in and of itself, but it does prove critical to understanding why left-leaning actors, including labor unions and their associated pensions, have sought very different things in state and federal settings. That's a complex matter that's illuminated more directly through some additional explanatory factors that really constitute the bulk of the paper. Now, I think one of the most important dimensions of this state-federal divide stems from the fact that the power base, the interests, and really even the identity of organized labor in the U.S. has evolved substantially over recent decades. There are really two core dimensions to this. The first is the rise of union-sponsored pensions as prominent institutional investors, and then conversely, the fall of union organizations themselves as representatives of U.S. labor. As the one has risen in significance over time, the other has fallen. So we have their posture as pension managers increasing in salience and their relevance as organizers of U.S. labor falling. Since the 1970s, so-called defined benefit pensions that guarantee a certain payout have largely been displaced by defined contribution pensions that simply guarantee a certain employer contribution, which obviously places the investment risk on the employee in that kind of arrangement. Whereas 65.8% of workers with employer-sponsored retirement plans in 1977 had defined benefit plans, so you had about two-thirds of workers with defined benefit plans in the late 70s. 20 years later, by 1997, it had flipped. 67.8% had defined contribution plans, and that rose to 77.5% by 2007. Now, as Martin Gelters explored, this effectively turned working families into investors. And that tended to blur the line between the employee-based identity that workers might have historically had and a more investor-based identity that began to sort of emerge under these circumstances. And I think this undeniably altered the politics of corporate governance and fueled the perception that various socioeconomic strata, notably the ill-defined middle class, have a substantial stake in the capital markets, and that the value of that stake could be materially improved through governance policies that strongly focus on shareholders, both in terms of power and in terms of purpose. Now, more pertinently for understanding the state-federal divide, there's the radically altered position of union organizations themselves relative to their associated pensions. American unions were at their very peak in 1954. In 1954, American unions represented about 25 million members who themselves constituted about 39% of the U.S. workforce. That was the zenith for American unions. By 2006, they dwindled to about 15.4 million members who represented just 12% of the U.S. workforce. So as pension investments came to the fore, the traditional organizing operations of unions began to recede. And this is critical to understanding how organized labor writ large could, for example, favor erecting takeover defenses in the 1980s, but then subsequently favor dismantling them. Particularly when you bear in mind that union pensions in the U.S. are heavily invested in stocks, and they have to generate substantial returns to be able to meet their current obligations to their pensioners. Now, as you might expect, this is thought to have prompted greater focus on stock price performance over relatively short time horizons. There's been considerable debate about whether union pensions have truly focused on maximizing shareholder wealth or really whether they've operated as a guise for advancing labor interests, say by targeting firms that have some kind of notorious labor problems. The empirical literature on this is mixed, and that may simply illustrate the contradictory position in which organized labor, again, writ large, finds itself in recent decades. That's illustrated, I think, by their equivocation on takeover defenses, as I noted, but also by ambivalence on whether their associated pensions should be making foreign investments, right? On the one, this was a big issue for these pensions in the 90s. The pensions might want to make foreign investments in order to generate returns, but the labor organization itself might view that as a mechanism by which they'd effectively be subsidizing U.S. job loss through offshoring. So very, very conflicted views as a consequence of that. In any event, in assessing the overall impacts here, it's important to bear in mind that wages and unionization rates have dropped substantially, while their pension shareholder activism has substantially enhanced the position of capital in corporate America. Now, a full explanation of why labor activism has tended so strongly towards shareholder empowerment at the federal level also requires some account of the legal context that these players inhabit. And this brings us to a very important federal statute called ERISA, which stands for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. Now, the aim of ERISA was to ensure responsible management of pension assets in private employer-sponsored retirement funds. And among other things, ERISA imposed fiduciary duties on plan managers that, as interpreted, have had the effect of essentially mandating an intense focus on maximizing returns to shareholders, but beyond that, really compelling union-sponsored pensions to engage in strong-form activism to enhance the overall degree of shareholder centrism in U.S. corporate governance. Plan managers' fiduciary duties require, among other things, that the fiduciary, quote, shall discharge his duties with respect to a plan solely in the interest of the participants and beneficiaries, and, quote, for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits to participants and their beneficiaries. This is an obligation of strict loyalty that has been understood to require intense focus on maximizing returns. Now, an interesting and I think ironic legal consequence is that interpretations of these ERISA fiduciary duties by the U.S. Department of Labor have been among the most consequential and highly shareholder-centric authoritative documents that you could identify anywhere in the U.S. legal landscape. The Department of Labor has stated in interpretive guidance that the, quote, fiduciary act of managing plan assets that are shares of corporate stock includes the voting of proxies appurtenant to those shares of stock. And in so doing, plan managers must, quote, not subordinate the interests of the participants and beneficiaries in their retirement income to unrelated objectives. But the Department of Labor's interpretive guidance on these fiduciary duties goes further, effectively requiring activism. The department says that a, quote, investment policy that contemplates activities intended to monitor or influence the management of corporations in which the plan owns stock is consistent with a fiduciary's obligations under ERISA. Now, lest there be any confusion here, the interpretive guidance goes on to provide an extensive list of concrete examples of issues on which plan managers might exert themselves, as well as indicating concrete modes of action expected. And to be clear, when the Department of Labor says it is consistent for with the fiduciaries for the plan managers to do X, that's understood to be close to a compulsion, because if one didn't do it, one would have to explain why. So the department here points to active monitoring and communication and notes that that may be carried out through a variety of methods, including by means of correspondence and meetings with corporate management, as well as by exercising the legal rights of a shareholder, which has sort of an ominous ring to it if you're in the perspective of corporate management. Now, reactions to this guidance in the financial press and in the investment plans of ERISA funds alike confirm that the market has not missed the DOL's message here. Affirmative, strong form shareholder activism is a de facto requirement for compliance with plan managers' fiduciary duties under ERISA, at least as the market understands the DOL's perspective. And we should note also that this has indirect effects for public pensions that are regulated at the state level, because they often have very similar fiduciary obligations for which this kind of guidance regarding the ERISA duties will often be taken as essentially persuasive authority on how to properly interpret the state level fiduciary duties that apply to the public pensions. Now, while all of this helps explain why organized labor's interests have skewed heavily towards shareholder centrism in recent decades, we still need an explanation as to why such preferences have found such a congenial home in the national politics of the left. And here we turn to the evolution of the Democratic Party over recent decades, focusing particularly on how the left's strategy for assembling a viable electoral coalition at the national level has actually unfolded since the 1990s. Now, while the political science literature tends to associate shareholder centrism with right-leaning politics, there's also an interesting offshoot of this literature that has observed that shareholder-centric policies are also strongly associated with right-leaning shifts over time of parties of the left. Right? So in other words, it's not solely associated with parties of the right. You also see it in left-leaning parties that shift rightward over time. And I think that's been vividly illustrated in the U.S. After decades in the political wilderness, the so-called New Democrat movement arose in the late 1980s and early 1990s as an effort essentially to re-envision the party in order to win national elections. And that strategy predominantly involved shifting the party toward the political center. Their core themes were opportunity, responsibility, and community. Those are the three words you would continually hear. Opportunity, responsibility, and community. And policies pursued under this banner drew both from traditional terrain of the left and of the right. So they wedded commitment to civil rights and civil liberties with rejection of outcomes-based social welfare policy, and then pursued policies like deficit reduction and international trade as means of achieving economic growth. Now, this sort of policy platform is widely credited with propelling Bill Clinton to victory in 1992. And as you all know, it inspired similar third-way political movements elsewhere, including Tony Blair's New Labor. Now, in the assembly of an electoral coalition, the New Democrats strongly cultivated support among the elite, highly educated professional class. This was a major effort in terms of the Democratic Party's outreach during this period, professionals, and that included financial professionals. The appeal was essentially that emphasis on education and elite credentials sort of massaged this shift away from emphasis on equality of outcomes toward equality of opportunities, as well as the fact that these professional constituencies tended to be socially liberal voters who were also, by the way, very affluent potential donors. All of this placed a positive face on the policy shifts that might otherwise have appeared callous toward the less affluent, and of course the trends noted earlier regarding greater middle class exposure to equity markets via pensions may well have tended to stabilize an otherwise unlikely coalition of finance with traditional labor interests. It's also tended to support resort to corporate governance reforms in the wake of crises, avoiding more robust regulatory responses to financial sector failings that the Democrats' wealthy financial donors did not want to see occur. Now, I recount this in some detail in the paper, but suffice to say that this strategy, and notably the embrace of finance, paid very, very handsomely for the Democratic Party. Democratic candidates have done very well raising money from finance-related constituencies, and it has to be said, finance appears to have done very well in return, notably in the form of deregulation, starting in the 1990s, lifting restrictions on interstate banking, repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act that for decades had separated investment banking from commercial banking, and so forth. Now, in discerning the relevance of all of this to the politics of corporate governance, the subject that we're really here to talk about, it's critical to recognize that Democratic Party operatives needn't necessarily care at all about any of these governance-related issues in the corporate realm, and may indeed know very little about them. Viewing this from a narrow instrumental perspective, their goal was simply to assemble a stable coalition that could finance a successful national electoral strategy. And if that coalition favors shareholders in the realm of corporate governance, then we shouldn't expect these party officials to lose too much sleep if there's an incoherence between the positions of the left at the state level and the federal level. I think there's some support for this view in the fact that Democratic Party platforms over the last few decades make very little reference to corporate governance, and in the rare instances when they do, there's virtually no meaningful discussion of any kind. Now, armed with the foregoing, one might reasonably ask where things go from here, and particularly what the prospects for convergence might be, as between the perspectives of the left at the state level with a greater stakeholder orientation and the shareholder orientation we find in the federal left. This is very, very difficult to predict given the uncertainties we now face in the U.S. political economy. Perhaps you can identify with that to some degree. Now, in the paper, I discuss various mechanisms, though, for potential convergence. Most dramatically, Congress might decide to federalize corporate law. I think that's exceedingly unlikely. It was tried a few times in the 20th century, it got nowhere, and there's no indication that Congress has any appetite for this. So let's quickly move on to another possibility, which is that convergence might occur through direct linkages between relevant state and federal actors. One example is a historically relatively recent amendment to the Constitution of the State of Delaware that allows the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission to directly certify questions of corporate law to the Delaware Supreme Court. Now, this has not been widely used, and of course it remains entirely discretionary from the federal perspective. Federal actors needn't take it up if they don't think they'll like what they'll hear from Delaware, or if they simply don't care what Delaware thinks on a given matter. Another intriguing possibility here is actually the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, oddly, in a couple of prominent decisions in recent years, the 2010 Citizens United decision that struck down campaign financing restrictions that had been directed at corporations, and then the 2014 Hobby Lobby decision that held that closely held for-profit corporations with religious owners can themselves, as corporations, invoke free exercise of religion protections under the federal Constitution. In these decisions, the conservative justices of the Supreme Court have adopted conceptions of the corporation and corporate law that are surprisingly compatible with positions advanced by the left at the level of state corporate law. Notably, the idea that corporations can legitimately prioritize non-shareholder interests. In a sense, this reflects the fact that the moral conservatives, unlike libertarian-leaning conservatives, can actually get quite comfortable with the notion that corporations can legitimately be about more than generating returns to capital. Now, this is quite interesting, but I don't think such developments are really going to go very far towards state-federal convergence, because for the myriad corporate law issues that do not involve a federal constitutional question, the final word on the content and meaning of state-level corporate law will remain the state legislatures and their highest courts, notably the Delaware General Assembly and the Delaware Supreme Court. Now, in terms of prospects for convergence, by far the most consequential development is the fact that following Hillary Clinton's unexpected loss to the fundamentally populist Republican candidate Donald Trump, the new Democratic coalition and the associated electoral strategy that I described earlier may effectively be dead. It's totally unclear at this point what the new coalition that emerges from their 2016 defeat will actually look like and what the party's course moving forward is going to be. But the early signs suggest that the more populist wing of the party is going to have a lot more influence. And here we're talking about Bernie Sanders, who hammered Clinton throughout the primary for abandoning traditional commitments to the poor and the working class. as well as Elizabeth Warren, who leans strongly in towards Sanders' position. Now, if this happens, then it's possible that Labor's traditional posture might return to the foreground in the formulation of the Democratic Party's platform moving forward. And of course, this could be reinforced over time if union pension activism were to wane. It's important to note that today's smaller pool of union members is going to translate into a smaller number of union pension beneficiaries in not too long a time, historically speaking. When that happens, union pension funds and their activism will start to wane in significance. Though, of course, that void may be filled by other forms of institutions with similar predilections. Now, naturally, all of this remains speculative at this point, but I do feel confident in venturing at least one prediction. Regardless of what happens, when it comes to the formulation of the Democratic Party's preferences for corporate governance at the federal level, electoral imperatives are going to remain paramount. Coherence across the multiple fields of state and federal law that constitute the U.S. corporate governance system simply is not an important value for any relevant actor in that arena. There is no real champion for this idea of greater coherence in their state and federal platforms. And accordingly, the federal left's corporate governance politics can be expected to move in whatever direction the wind blows. Now, if that's in the direction of consistency with state-level progressive preferences, that might be great from a certain political perspective, but it would be a matter of pure coincidence, and I don't think it would last any longer than the larger political forces that motivated that shift in the first place. Okay, thank you very much. And I'll be very happy to answer any questions about any aspect of the project that you may have, and certainly welcome any comments or suggestions that you may have in pursuing it further.
Thank you.